It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll catch up with the filmmaker Mark Borchert, who was the subject of the 1999 award-winning documentary American Movie.
First off, we take a look at what the Secret Service is up against after a very bad week for the agency. With the resignation of former director Julia Pearson over numerous security failures, the service has tapped former Presidential Protective Division Chief Joe Clancy to temporarily head that agency until a permanent director can be found.
One thing seems clear: whoever permanently takes over the position of Secret Service Director faces an uphill battle when it comes to restoring trust and restoring the service's image.
Joining us now to talk about the ongoing Secret Service story is Josh Gerstein. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. Josh, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be with you guys.
So, Josh, unusual bipartisan agreement on this one. It seems like everyone in Congress agrees that this last round of scandals at the Secret Service was a really big deal.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why we saw the Secret Service director forced out in a relatively short period of time. It became pretty clear that Julia Pearson didn't have the confidence of either the Democrats or the Republicans on Capitol Hill. And Republicans, who are often very critical of President Obama, really turned their fire on the Secret Service as an agency, didn't do much bashing of the president, and simply were flabbergasted at some of these mistakes and errors that have taken place in recent weeks.
A lot of stakeholders new leadership will have to win over, starting with the boss, President Obama. He can't be happy about the current performance. Even with a new director, how can the Secret Service earn the president's trust again?
Well, you know, they're going to bring in, as you said, this new director who had a prior relationship with President Obama, who was as head of the president's detail for several years at the beginning of the administration. So he's somebody who knows the president personally, who knows the president's top staff personally. So hopefully that would begin moving the process in the right direction. I think he's also going to have to commit to complete candor. One of the problems that has happened here is that it appears that the president and the top White House staff were not getting a full readout on all these problems. They were getting kind of grudging information when they asked for it instead of proactive disclosures. Apparently, people at the White House didn't know about this incident at the CDC in an elevator where you had a man who was armed, who had some kind of criminal past, who basically shouldn't have been in that elevator. The White House didn't learn about that until moments before it was reported publicly.
Yeah, I mean, the Secret Service, secrecy is half their name, but do they need to be more transparent to the president and the public?
I think they definitely do need to be more transparent. They've had a tradition, for example, of doing their own internal investigations. They have a professional responsibility office. A lot of other government agencies answer to an inspector general, who's someone who's presidentially appointed, has no connection whatsoever, usually, to the agency that they are inspecting, and can issue reports directly to Congress. The Secret Service, at least since the Department of Homeland Security took them over a decade or so ago, has never been subject to a true inspector general, has always done their own internal reports. It's kind of a strange carve-out, and I think it leads to just less transparency both to Congress, the public, and perhaps to the White House. I think we're going to see that process, that special carve-out for the Secret Service, come to an end.
Is there talk of doing that already, some kind of outside inspection?
Well, we're already looking at a top-to-bottom inspection. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson is going to appoint a group of wise men and women to look at these recent incidents and then the recent pattern of potential problems at the Secret Service and make recommendations. But I would be shocked if legislation that comes off Capitol Hill doesn't alter the process for internal reviews at the Secret Service. And then, of course, the big question is, if Mr. Clancy doesn't become the permanent director, would the president perhaps install someone from another law enforcement agency instead of the Secret Service, breaking the tradition of promoting from within there at that agency?
And you mentioned Capitol Hill. Congress not happy with the Secret Service, obviously. How does a new director, new management go about winning back congressional support and trust?
Well, this could be one of the trickiest things, because these directors, at least the ones promoted from inside the agency, don't tend to be particularly savvy at politics and understanding how things work on Capitol Hill. So this might be another area where someone who's had to deal with politics in another realm might actually be able to manage the personalities and so forth on Capitol Hill a little bit better. It'd probably be someone good to have someone who can handle a congressional hearing or inquiry better than Director Pearson did the other day. She just seemed very defensive, and while her language may have said that they were determined to get to the bottom of it, her body language spoke otherwise, as if she was not very comfortable having to represent the agency at that hearing. I think they're going to need to have someone who's more of a public personality who can do both the congressional appearances and maybe even appear in the media to talk about what the Secret Service's responsibilities are.
Now, here's maybe a big deal. There's been talk that maybe potential assassins or White House intruders have been deterred by an aura of invulnerability from the Secret Service. Does this open the door to imitators, to, I don't know, terrorists even, to say, hey, they're not as tough as we thought they were?
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, one agent I spoke to said that the White House is already a magnet for people suffering from all kinds of mental illnesses and psychological confusion. So now you're going to have more discussion in the media leading to possible copycats. I'm less concerned that a person like that is going to actually make it into the White House or to the president under the current circumstances, and more concerned that there's going to be some use of force, perhaps deadly force, to stop them when that might not have been necessary in the past. And then you also have to wonder if terrorists or other people that want to do the president harm of a more serious mindset, maybe looking at some of these recent breaches and getting the idea that maybe the Secret Service isn't all it's been cut out to be. And they might attempt something, again, that, you know, may well not be successful, but could still cause a lot of damage, injury, and bloodshed. And so that's one of the greatest concerns here, that, you know, the Secret Service is not flawless, but they benefit from the perception that they're very, very good at what they do.
Josh, a story to follow. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, anytime. Take care.
That's Josh Gerstein. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. He joined us to discuss the challenges facing the new leadership at the Secret Service.
Coming up next, we meet a Wisconsin legend, filmmaker Mark Borchert, made famous in the documentary American Movie.
For this week's Wisconsin Legends segment, we turn the lens on Wisconsin independent filmmaker Mark Borchert. He was featured in the 1999 documentary American Movie, which followed Mark and his eccentric crew of family and friends through the struggles of making the movie Coven, a low-budget independent horror film.
That year, the documentary won the Sundance Film Festival's Grand Jury Prize, and in the years since has developed a cult-like following, due in part to Mark's passionate approach to life and filmmaking.
American Movie garnered Mark international attention, including appearances on David Letterman and Family Guy, and cameos in several large-budget Hollywood films. We recently caught up with the Milwaukee native and talked to him about his love for cinema and what he's been up to since that documentary. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So when did you first know that you wanted to devote your life to making films?
Well, I wanted to devote my life to my life about 5 years old, when I'd look up at the stars at night in the city and think, wow, what a wondrous opportunity this all is. I began writing first. Film came at the age of 14. I never was one for movies. I thought them infantile and nothing to do with the life that was actually being lived. I'd look at film books, though, and study the dramatic black and white stills and you know, just really regale myself in their compositions. And that's what excited me about film. I guess my imagination was on, you know, full speed ahead looking at those publicity stills and so forth. Mm. And, you know, begin to wonder what the films were about and so forth. So I came to film a different way. Like I said, I wasn't really into quote-unquote movies. I was into film from the get-go.
And I didn't know this until just today, you did some radio dramas, Halloween radio dramas in Milwaukee. What were those like?
Sure. Actually, I was just thinking about that because, you know, someone said, hey, you know, you're on the air. I've been in front of a mic since like 94 when I did 3 years of radio dramas, wrote, produced, and directed them, you know, and it was a full professional mix, and I've always listened to Suspense and Inner Sanctum and Lights Out and Escape and The Mysterious Traveler, et cetera, which should ring a bell with you guys.
Yeah.
as I listen to year after year after year as well of WHAD 8 to 11 on Sunday nights for old time radio drama. But I will say I started listening to radio dramas over 30 years ago, though.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the making of your film, Coven. It was captured in the documentary American Movie. You got international attention from that and a cult following. Can you tell us what you learned from that process and the aftermath and all that exposure that came afterwards?
Oh, you don't learn anything. You learn that one never changes. It's the people that are around them that change and their reactions and so forth. And there's the good-hearted aspect of it. There's a superficial aspect of all of that stuff. I never thought twice about it. It's not in my psyche. It's not in my bloodstream. When I made Coven, it was a great time. I shot it on 16mm black and white. And I knew what was going on when I was filming, and I'm very happy about the compositions with the scarecrows and all of that. With that, I got exactly what I wanted with the music, those opening credits. That's all I had hoped to accomplish aesthetically, and that is where I stand, you know. It was a cantankerous ordeal doing Coven. You know, you're dealing with lights, you're dealing with different crew members, you know, and you're a fluctuating schedule. And it was a 3-year effort, and it was really cool. It paid off and got it done.
Nowadays, a lot of filmmakers and others are using a crowdfunding, things like Kickstarter, to bring their works to reality. Have you looked into doing that? If you'd had it available back then, would you have used it for your previous projects?
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm just not interested in involving myself with a bunch of people. I have a singular personality. I've got my own agenda, my own continuing narrative, and the more people you encounter, the more potential that your singular narrative can be prone to being diluted, and I don't go for that. So, you know, who knows?
You know, another thing that's changed since you've made Coven is that people have talked a lot about the democratization of the movie-making process and that, you know, you don't have to be a Hollywood studio. There are still indie filmmakers, but they have so many more options now. There are smaller handheld cameras. There's the internet and YouTube. Do you think it's easier now to make it as a filmmaker than it used to be?
It's absolutely easier to make it as a filmmaker on a couple counts, technically, of course, because there's no longer a cost for film stock or anything like that. I mean, it's anyone can actually do it, and many do. And now also filmmaking has come into the popular culture. You're no longer you feel a sense of ostracization saying you're a filmmaker. That's just part of the culture now. I mean, 10, 20 years from now, a writer, you know, if you're a novelist, it'll be like a filmmaker as literature seeps more and more into the populist psyche as film has done.
You've obviously got a lot of passion about filmmaking. It's almost contagious, and your story has inspired other people to make their own films. What advice would you have for somebody thinking, I think I have a film in me, I don't know how to start, I don't know what to do?
This is pretty platitudinous, but you have to be original, because if you are copying some other paradigm, you know, some other genre, and it's apparent that you're copying it, you're dead in the water. But if you have an original voice and it's really from the heart and you put genuine effort into it, that's the best advice one can give, along with taking it very seriously, being as prepared as you can and courteous and respectful to those, you know, that you find yourself, your colleagues that you're working with.
I want to ask a little bit about you, if you don't mind, because through your appearances on Letterman, other exposure in the media, people got really curious about you as a person. And I wonder now, you know, years down the road after some of that has died down, what is your day-to-day life like? Do you still roll out of bed and the first thing on your mind is making film? Is that your 9-to-5 job?
No, it never has been. And I've never thought about media appearances ever. I've never talked about it. I've never thought about it. You know, again, I'm thankful for whatever, you know, may happen. I'm thankful for the parking spot I got getting here. Your lot was packed, but, you know, I had patience. I came early, and someone had pulled out, and there's that one space, and you know, with preparation and contingency time, you know, it was, we got here on time.
So you're not a superstar, you know, anymore, at least. But,
I was a superstar to myself since 1966. I don't, like I said, I don't get into any of this media stuff. Never have, never will. You never thought twice about it. I mean, as in for any, you know, a media attraction, literally never ends. That never had its heyday. I mean, that continues, especially with the electronic universe. You open yourself up to it, and it's like a floodgate. There's no end. There's no peak. There's no valley. It just rolls on. If you so choose to get involved with that sort of lifestyle and thinking, that never ends.
And filmmaking, is it still your number one passion? It's still what you do from 9 to 5. What's on your mind most of the day?
Oh, I don't do anything from 9 to 5. I'm 24 hours of who I am. I write every day. That's number one. Filmmaking to me is a spiritual thing. I don't have anything to do with independent filmmaking. It's a personal agenda, and so on and so forth. So it's completely maybe different in my aspect.
You've been an actor in other people's projects. I could see it going either way. Like, it would be way easier because all the logistics and everything else, they're on that other person. I could see it being harder, too, like, because you know kind of what they need from you. How does acting compare to making a film?
Acting compared to making a film is entirely different. There are actually many, many professional actors. I mean, at the height of the craft, you have De Niro and so on and so forth. This is what they do. Pacino, Strasberg, all of that. That this is their lives. This is their craft. This is what they believe in. Other people, they merely show up in front of the frame and exude their personality. So it's a different level of acting. It's just an amplified sense of self. So obviously, you have to be responsible. You learn your lines. You know, you learn them. You know, you study them the day before. It's like a military operation, day to day to day to day of studying acting, studying acting, studying acting. And, you know, if you're responsible, you know your lines, you're able to perform and all as well.
Now, you said earlier on that the films that you were seeing were not reflective of real life. So I'm curious, today, 2014, are you seeing movies right now that you loved? Have you seen one that you love?
Oh no! The concept of movies, it's the concept, the overall concept is a populist entertainment, which I never had any interest in whatsoever. No, I've always been immersed, like in Antonioni and Bergman and Tarkovsky and Wells and Polanski, Dreyer, et cetera, on and on and on. I've never kowtowed to any populist bent or wasted a great amount of time with any of that other stuff.
Have you seen anything that you loved lately?
Let's see. In the mid-80s was Jim Jarmusch's Down by Law. In around mid-90s was Slam, Mark Levin's Slam. In the after the turn of the century and into the teens was Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. Now, that's for films that I encountered at the time that they came out, you know. So those, each decade, that 80s was Down by Law, 90s Slam, present, Tree of Life. But again, those are not my references. My reference are Bergman's Hour of the Wolf, Scenes from a Marriage, Persona, Shame, Face to Face, Autumn Sonata, you know, Antonioni's Mysteries, Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc, Vampyr, Day of Wrath, Ordet, Gertrude, all of that. I mean, it just on and on and on. I mean, I don't reference. I have no dealings with. I don't receive things, you know, ambiguously. I do my research and then move forward from that.
Well, what is next on the filmmaking horizon for you? Do you have a project in the works or in mind?
I've got a whole stack of things I got to send out for registration and copyright, various written projects and so on and so forth. So film-wise, yeah, that's interesting. I shot 4 different projects, but I don't sit in front of screens, so I don't edit. You know, I don't – life's too short to be looking at a screen. So you know, I'm really into the process. Had a really great time shooting dozens of hours of footage, and someday I may assemble it. And as for any upcoming film projects, if it strikes me, absolutely. Again, you know, I like to think, I like to read, I like to write. Those have always been my main agenda, and filmmaking was a way to show the outside world, or, you know, amplify those interests to the point where other people could experience them. So I will say, though, I'm in Frankie Latina's new film, Snapshot. And Frankie Latina is just this outstanding filmmaker here in Milwaukee who did Modus Operandi on Super 8. And now he, again, got Danny Trejo to town and Cade Carradine to star in his new masterpiece shot on Super 16, Snapshot.
Well, Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you. No, it was wonderful. What a delight.
That was Mark Borchert, writer, filmmaker, and Milwaukee native.
If you traveled to your local county fair over the summer or even the state fair, there's a good chance you saw the hard work of the state's 4-H members. While this year was mostly business as usual for the kids involved in the organization, 2014 is a special year for 4-H as it celebrates its 100th anniversary.
While the organization is probably best known for its agricultural roots, 4-H is looking toward new initiatives to ensure that it stays relevant to today's kids and sticks around for another 100 years.
Here to talk about the organization's past and to give us a glimpse of 4-H's future is Dale Lighthizer. He's the State Program Director for 4-H Youth Development. He joins us here in the studio. Dale, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
Well, first, congratulations. 100 years, big deal. What is it about 4-H you think that's led it to make it this long?
You know, that's a real good question. I think it goes back in history to really the foundation of our program, going back to the origins of the land-grant university system. In 1863, President Lincoln signed the legislation that granted land to all of our states, and here in Wisconsin, UW-Madison is our original land-grant university. We've really expanded to all of the other institutions around the state as well with our Wisconsin idea. But it goes back to that and really trying to take advantage of the technologies and innovations out of the research of the institution and trying to help people really learn and grow, and at that point in time, 100 years ago, really advance agriculture and try to make farmers more profitable.
Now, for people who don't know what 4-H is all about, how would you describe it?
Boy, that's a really good question. The way I would describe it today is that we are an organization about positive youth development. That's really the focus. I think over the years, we've had different measuring sticks about our program. And the measuring stick in the early 1900s was about hybrid corn. That was the innovation that was part of the research of the land-grant universities, and farmers were not adopting that practice. It really required them to purchase corn seed rather than to just keep back a volume of the fertile seed that they had been used to. And so those innovators back in the early 1900s decided, let's get boys together, have them plant demonstration plots, and from the demonstration to their parents, really encourage the adoption of innovation. So, you know, that was the measuring stick then. What will cause farmers to increase their yield? And over the years, we've had different measuring sticks, and really the measuring stick today is about preparing young people for their future. And we do that in a lot of different ways, but it's about what happens to young people after they've been in our program and engage in society as adults and become taxpayers, become, well, you know, working in the in communities and contributing to our community culture.
Well, we better ask you early on here, what are the 4-H's and what do they mean?
The 4-H's are head, heart, hands, and health. I think it might have been in the 1920s that one of the H's was hustle for a short amount of time, but that got changed into health. And what we take a look at now is we've got elements that are essential to our programs. And we talk about belonging, independence, generosity, and mastery. And it really describes what it is we're after. If we don't have those elements present in our programs, then we're not doing our work to really prepare young people for what happens after they graduate from high school. And one of the most important of those really is belonging. And I think that we all see that with young people and adults as well. If they don't feel like they belong to a group, they're going to walk and they're going to go to a place where they feel like they do belong. So it's really important for us that belonging is the most critical element that has to be there and in place for young people to participate.
So these days, how big a presence is 4-H here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a lot bigger than people really think. You know, we fight the stereotype about 4-H being for young people that are on farms and ranches, engaged in agriculture, raising livestock and crops. And the reality is that in Wisconsin, we have this past year about 355,000 young people. Okay. Across the state in every county from our East Metro region surrounding Milwaukee, lots of young people in Green Bay, up the whole Fox River Valley, and across the rest of the state. So to support those young people, we had about 15,000 volunteers, primarily parents of all of these young people that are really engaging them in communities, in small groups and communities everywhere. So it's not just for those rural agricultural kids, although that's part of our history and heritage, and we've got to have programming available for young people no matter where they happen to live.
Well, and that's reflected in my visits to county fairs and the state fair in the last couple of years. Yes, there's the agricultural stuff we think of, the rabbits and the livestock and the plants, and then the robotics and graphic design. I think talk about some of the non-agricultural fields you've moved into.
You know, it's kind of interesting, and I think that as we take a look at what's happened with education across the board, K-12 in particular, and the research that's come out and the publicity about how young people in the United States are falling behind other countries in relation to science and technology, that there's been a huge push for those fields in particular. And STEM education, as we refer to it today, is about science, technology, engineering, and math. And so we were able to hire a STEM specialist here in Wisconsin 4 years ago who is really helping to lead our effort. Now, we can go back to those corn clubs back in 1904 and really be able to say that was really about STEM education then. Mm-hmm. And throughout our history, we've relied upon research as the foundation of the projects that we've offered. And today we're really trying to put more emphasis into that to really generate interest in young people about fields that relate to science, technology, engineering, and math.
Do you think your image has kept up with the times? Do you think people think about those STEM associations when they think of 4-H, or are they still just thinking about the bunnies and the livestock?
Well, you know, people go to county fairs, and when they do see the livestock and the bunnies and the crops and things that are on exhibit, there are times that it does reinforce some of those stereotypes. But, you know, we've really got to take a look at how we go about marketing and communicating what it is we do, what the results are. And we've had some great long-term research in recent years out of the Tufts University. And that Tufts study points out that young people that are part of our programs are more likely to get A's and B's. They're more likely to be engaged in their communities. Girls in 4-H are more likely to go into science and technology fields in post-high school education, whether that's technical schools or community colleges or four-year colleges. Young people that are in 4-H are less likely to engage in negative behaviors, things that really cost us as a society money. Young people in 4-H are less likely to be in cars where drivers are drinking and driving. They're less likely to text. They're less likely to vandalize. You know, there are a lot of measures that we've got that really indicate what happens to young people in our program. The long-term benefit is how they contribute to their communities. That's really the bonus. So, you know, this is a great opportunity for us to talk about 4-H in our state and across the country and the results that we have. And, you know, in a way, it's marketing, and we just want to dispel the misconceptions and help people understand what it is we're really all about.
As we talk about 4-H, we'll go to a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Tina on the line in La Crosse. Tina, hi.
Hi. Yes, I called in to give a compliment. I didn't realize you were going to go more into the technology. Our middle son was really involved in 4-H. He graduated college at Stevens Point and went off to the Peace Corps in Africa. And he found the things he learned in his 4-H projects were more useful than the high-level agricultural and botany studies at a university for actually, you know, tribal agriculture in Central Africa. And he actually, I sent him some of his 4-H books that he had, his poultry projects he had through the years.
No kidding. Tina, thank you so much. Is that a story that you hear often, Dale, people looking back on their 4-H practical careers and putting it into practice in Wisconsin or Africa, for that matter?
Oh, yeah. It's been really interesting to me. In the past year, I've had calls from or emails from people in a number of different countries who are in 4-H in our state, and they're doing work through the Peace Corps or USAID or other organizations doing international work and wondering how can they use our 4-H materials to support the work they're trying to accomplish in developing countries or in Haiti, where they've had large issues with the earthquake a number of years ago, and people just really taking advantage of not just the resources we have about the subject matter, but the process that we have that stands underneath it.
Thanks for that call, Tina. We're talking with Dale Lighthizer about the 100th anniversary of 4-H, and we want to hear from you, too.
Were you in 4-H when you were a child? And if so, what are some of your memories of your time with the organization? And how do you think the lessons learned in 4-H have benefited you later in life? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Dale Lighthizer, State Program Director for 4-H Youth Development. This year marks the 100th anniversary of 4-H, and we're hearing the story of the organization's past century while taking a look at the future as well.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think 4-H is still relevant to today's kids? And what programming would you like to see offered? If you were a 4-H-er any time in, say, the past 100 years, what was that experience like? Call us at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Rachel on the line in Madison. Rachel, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was in 4-H for 12 years, and throughout that time was president and secretary of my club, and I also got to go to Australia through it for a month, and it was just a great experience.
Rachel, what were some of the projects that you did over the years in 4-H?
I did poultry, swine, cake decorating, which was one of my big ones, and photography and arts and crafts. So I kind of did a little bit of everything.
Wow. Rachel, thanks so much. That's one of the problems I have with the fair exhibits. There's all these beautiful cakes, and you don't get to eat any of them.
Yeah, but I was just going to ask, Rachel, what are some of the life skills that you really gained from being in 4-H over the years?
Well, we always had to give speeches at our meetings on topics that were important to us. So it helped you, you know, be a better leader and be able to talk to people in public. And we always were doing public service things, you know, cleaning up roads and things like that. So, I mean, it really just, you give back to your community all the time.
Rachel, thanks a lot for sharing that story. She mentioned that time in Australia. So I understand 4-H does international exchange programs.
Yeah, we have a variety of international exchanges. I think a year ago, we probably had different kind of exchanges with about 15 different countries around the world. And we've got a bunch of young people that are here in Wisconsin this year. We have year-long exchanges where families can really have an international experience in their own home by hosting a young person in high school, and travel experiences like Rachel has gone on to Australia. So we've got a number of countries that we collaborate with, and Japan is one of those that we have the best relationships with, and we will host about, 50 kids here during the summertime for a 3-week time period. So there are short experiences and longer experiences, both for families that are part of our program.
Let's take a comment here on Facebook. This is from Laura, who says, I wasn't fortunate enough to participate in 4-H as a kid, but now I'm involved as a parent and a volunteer leader. I'm amazed by the opportunities that 4-H makes available to my kids: competitive shooting sports, robotics, models, rocketry, swine, llamas, lobbying with lawmakers in Madison, and so much more. We feel so very fortunate to belong to such a fantastic organization. So interesting. You know, I'm on board here
knowing what makes sense with the swine and the llamas, rocketry, we talked about STEM stuff, but lobbying with lawmakers. So 4-H has some programs that are political.
I wouldn't say that it's political, but part of this centennial activity that we've got going on this year is to really do some more public awareness. And because we're part of the land-grant university system, because we're part of the University of Wisconsin, we get funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture through the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. We get funding through the state of Wisconsin, through the university system. And then our big collaborators, cooperators, are county boards across the state as well. So we have these partnerships. And I wouldn't say that it's lobbying, but it's really informing our stakeholders about the work that we do, the progress that we make, and what the public value is of the work in relation to the tax dollars that we receive. And the benefits are far greater than the investments, but it really does take an investment to really get young people to be able to contribute to society in the long run.
We'll get back to our callers. We've got Larry on the line in Dubuque. Larry, hi.
Hi, thanks. To make a long story short, I'm originally from around Chicago and was never in 4-H as a child, but I teach now, and one of my elementary students, I was teaching ukulele to them, like basic chords, that kind of starting info, and I found out over the summer that she had used the lessons as a personal 4-H project and won, I think it's called a Youth Grand Champion, if the name is correct or not, but I never knew that 4-H could stretch across so many different topics other than your typical farming and other stuff like that.
Larry, thanks a lot. Congratulations. Keep teaching that ukulele.
Yeah, we've got a lot of different projects, Larry, and I think that one of the things that young people can do is they can design their own projects as well. What, you know, they can outline what the learning objectives happen to be and really try to develop a course of work where they can explore different topics and be able to exhibit those. And that exhibiting is about demonstrating to others what it is the learning is that's taken place.
Now, you've been talking about a 4-H that's looking forward to the future and some of the STEM aspects that are part of 4-H. What have you done to reach out to kids in urban areas? Because traditionally the image was rural kids with 4-H, but you're getting bigger and expanding and offering new things. So what is the effort there to bring in urban kids?
Yeah, you know, that's a big challenge for us. There are so many opportunities that young people in urban areas have compared to more rural areas. We might be one of the biggest games in town and really rural Wisconsin, but in Milwaukee and Waukesha, Racine, Kenosha, you know, some of those communities, there are a lot of other opportunities that we really compete against. And so it's a challenge for us to really market and change some of those opinions of people. One of the things that we're really starting to take a look at, and I reflect back on Laura's comments about how she wasn't fortunate enough to participate in 4-H as a child, but she is participating as a parent and a volunteer right now. And it's really the word of mouth that has a lot of power with people. And it's some of those first-generation families like Laura and her children that are some of the biggest advocates for what it is we do and the benefits that they see for children. So we really rely on word of mouth. We don't have a lot of resources. I think we can all admit freely that that state resources, public funding, has been challenged across the board, and we're subject to that as well. So we really want to take advantage of the word of mouth in communities where people know one another, they trust their neighbors, and if they've got a relationship, that they can really advocate on our behalf.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Lee on the line in Shell Lake. Lee, hi.
Hi. I just had to call in and say what an impression 4-H has had on my life. It's been probably the most important thing. Introduced me to Madison, UW-Madison, through State 4-H Club Week, through record keeping and leadership opportunities, getting to go to Chicago and Washington, D.C. It made a huge impact on my life.
Lee, thank you so much for sharing that. He mentioned leadership. Is that one of the goals that you're hoping kids take out of 4-H?
Yeah, we've got a life skill model that was developed by a researcher at at Iowa State University that identifies 35 different life skills that are part of our program. And it includes things that Leah's just mentioned: leadership, communication skills, record keeping is something that's really important. Record keeping is one of those things I'm surprised that no one has talked yet about record books. It seems to be the scorn of young people that are in the program, but for adults that have been part of the program, it's one of those assets that they really appreciate. Hmm. And a skill that it's about record keeping and not record doing. You know, I think all of us that pay taxes on April 14th, if we're doing things at the last minute, we know what a pain that is. And record keeping, being able to do that routinely over the course of the year, is a much better skill for all of us. And it takes a lot of self-discipline to do that.
Let's go back to our phones now. We've got Eddie on the line from Marshfield. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
I wanted to talk about how 4-H helps young boys and girls develop their skills as leaders. Our daughter joined 4-H about 3 years ago, and we have seen a dramatic change in her development. She has just blossomed as a leader. She is organized, she is poised, she's gone to the legislature to advocate for education. She's gone to Washington, D.C. to meet Congress people. She's just become a very, very organized and poised person. And it's all because she took part in 4-H.
Oh, so interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us, Eddie. You know, I'm intrigued with the number of people talking about the leadership skills gained in 4-H. It might not be the first thing people think of when they think about involvement. Do you want to talk a little bit about why those skills are part and parcel of this program?
Yeah, they get developed at an early age. What we have as our primary program model are clubs. And young people that at a young age, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, might participate on a committee. And being part of a committee that makes a decision is a leadership skill. It's about learning how to work with others. It's learning how to make decisions. It's learning fundamental principles about parliamentary procedure. And developing those skills over time, maybe a person is part of a committee, part of a group, they're talking about the community service they might want to do over the course of the year, and then they become an officer. They might be the club secretary, the club treasurer, where they keep track of things that are going on in the club, take minutes, and work with the checkbook. And eventually, they take more and more leadership positions.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Dale, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me here.
That's Dale Lighthizer. He's the State Program Director for 4-H Youth Development. He joined us to talk about the organization on its 100th anniversary, looking some at its past and their plans for the future. And there's still time for you to share your stories over at the Central Time Facebook page if you have a 4-H memory you'd like to share with us.